Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels, where discussions are focused on how to get around Afghan President Karzai's foot-dragging and obstruction, which is delaying a withdrawal agreement and post-withdrawal plans to support Afghanistan's military. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was the deputy head of the UN mission in Afghanistan until he was fired for blowing the whistle on Karzai's rigged re-election, joins us to discuss why Karzai won't sign the deal his own hand-picked lawyer Jirga has approved. Then, as the deadline for a budget agreement to relieve the sequester cuts approaches, we will speak with Joe Comerford, the executive director of the National Priorities Project, who is critical of the secretive negotiations and is calling for an open, transparent budget process. We will discuss House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan's resistance to ending tax loopholes for the very rich to replace the worst sequester cuts as he protects high-end tax shelters and instead wants to make cuts that impact middle-class and working Americans. Then finally, we'll speak with Deanne Lunan, the director of the Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project at the National Consumer Law Center, about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau now having authority over companies that collect payments for student loans after years of lax oversight by the Department of Education. We'll discuss outstanding student debt that has doubled in recent years to $1.2 trillion, with defaults at record levels, which economists warn is sapping economic strength and growing and holding back the U.S. economy. Joining us now is Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations missions in Afghanistan before being forced out over a conflict on how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. A former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, in 1995 he was the co-mediator and principal architect of the agreement that ended the war in Croatia, and from 2000 to 2001 he served with the United Nations in East Timor. He's also a professor of national security strategy at the National War College and is currently a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. His books include Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies, and The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Good to be with you.
And the NATO foreign ministers are meeting in Brussels, and apparently they're very frustrated, as is both President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry, with Hamid Karzai, who's refusing to sign a security agreement, which his own hand-picked lawyer Jirga, that's the Council of Tribal Elders, have endorsed. So this could have some serious consequences. NATO could simply be forced to withdraw all of its troops from Afghanistan by the end of the year, and that would end the possibility of NATO helping train the Afghan army after the withdrawal.
Well, the frustration of the NATO foreign ministers, as well as President Obama and Secretary Kerry, is obviously completely understandable. NATO and the United States have been shoring up Karzai for 12 years now, putting up with his antics, and a time when a critical decision is being made for the future of his country, a decision which is, as you point out, backed by the lawyer Jirga, the tribal elders that he himself chose, clearly backed by a large majority of the people of Afghanistan, according to polling, supported by the major contenders to replace Mr. Karzai in the presidential elections next year. He is nonetheless stalling, in some sense playing Russian roulette with the future of his country.
And this is following a visit last week by National Security Advisor Susan Rice. Do you know what happened with that meeting? It clearly didn't end with a resolution.
No. That's what I know, is that it didn't end. Mr. Karzai's most recent statement suggests what I suspected from the beginning, that his real concern is about the upcoming presidential elections. As listeners may recall, in 2009, he secured a second term as president in elections that were massively fraudulent. Probably a third of his ballots were manufactured. He reacted very angrily to the suggestion that it was fraudulent up to a certain point, and then he conceded it was fraudulent, but then argued that the U.S. and the U.N. had rigged the elections. And so he does not wish to see international supervision or scrutiny of the upcoming elections. And I suspect that's because he has a plan to rig these elections as he did in 2009. His own brother is running, and he has several close allies that are also running.
So that's why he says he won't sign the agreement until after the elections.
That's right. And he has said that one of the reasons he won't sign the agreement until after the elections is that he doesn't want the U.S. interfering in the elections, which is another way of saying that he doesn't want the U.S. or the United Nations pushing for an honest ballot.
So, again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan before being forced out over a conflict of how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Croatia and served with the United Nations in East Timor and was also a professor of national security strategy at the National War College. Now, I must say that the fact that one of his brothers is running to succeed him, it's pretty, in terms of the pantheon of candidates in this upcoming election, it's the bad and the uglier, isn't it? I mean, you've got an accused pedophile, a warlord. It's a pretty depressing bunch of people, isn't it? I mean, they're not all as dreadful, but it's a pretty depressing pantheon.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of very depressing candidates in the election. It has to be pointed out that one of Karzai's brothers was very much involved in the Kabul bank scandal, in which he secured a 7% stake in the bank that handled all of Afghanistan's finances. The money basically was looted and went off to Dubai in speculative real estate deals. And he got his stake. The bank loaned him the money to get that 7% stake, the kind of sweetheart deal that all of us would love. And of course, there's been no investigation, no punishment. And some of the other candidates are also dreadful. But there are also there are a couple of candidates of integrity. One of them is Abdullah Abdullah, who was the foreign minister and who came in second in the elections in 2009, and frankly, in my view, had those elections been conducted honestly, he might actually have won them in the runoff. But he is now, according to public opinion polls, the clear front runner for president in 2014. And I think what we will be looking at is to see whether the election results reflect the public opinion polls. I mean, one advantage of polling is, in fact, it's one good way to detect fraud. I mean, of course, polls aren't always right, but if a candidate ends up having a tiny number of votes and ends up winning, then you can view the election with great suspicion.
Now, Karzai's nominally a Pashtun, is he not? And that's always been considered something of an advantage, although I don't imagine that he's held in high regard by the Pashtuns, is he?
Well, Karzai is a Pashtun, and the Pashtuns are about 45% to 48% of Afghanistan's population. But, of course, the Taliban are also Pashtuns. It's almost an entirely Pashtun movement. So Karzai does not have the support of all Pashtuns. A sizable number support the Taliban, and even among those who are not on the Taliban side, there are other Pashtun contenders. Abdullah Abdullah is handicapped for being considered a Tajik, although in some sense he's the one real Afghan in the election, because while his father is Tajik, his mother is Pashtun. So he has both major ethnic groups in his background, but he is considered to be a Tajik, and they're about 25% of the population. Nonetheless, when he ran in 2009, he did get some significant support among the Pashtuns.
So are those divisions, do you think, looming in this post-withdrawal scenario?
Well, this is one of the great dangers. If the elections are, again, fraudulent, and if there's a sense on the part of the people in the north, who are not the Pashtuns but the Tajiks, the Hazaras, which is a Shiite minority, Uzbeks, and some others, if they sense that the election has been stolen, then the risk of civil war greatly increases. That is, a civil war between not just the civil war among the Pashtuns between the backers of Karzai and the Taliban, but a civil war between the Pashtuns and the Tajiks and the other groups, the Northerners. So that certainly is one of the dangers that looms in this upcoming crisis. You know, Mr. Karzai's, frankly, I can only describe it as his selfishness, has done great damage to his country. In 2009, Afghanistan had a great opportunity with the surge that President Obama had initiated. It involved tripling the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, a huge influx of aid. Other countries were contributing. And then he directed the fraud in the elections, and that, frankly, the fallout from all that undercut international support for the surge. The troop contributing countries began to look to getting their troops out. Aid dried up, and it also undercut the basic strategy that the U.S. and its allies were pursuing, which is a counterinsurgency strategy that, by its own doctrine, depends on having a local partner. And when your partner is, as Karzai is, corrupt, ineffective, and then also illegitimate, well, there was no partner. And, of course, the strategy didn't work.
Well, some analysts I've spoken to describe Afghanistan's government under Karzai as a narco-kleptocracy. So does he really care about the country or care about his own family and clan's wealth?
Well, clearly, some of his family members, including his brother, have made a huge amount of money. And it's hard to imagine that he's not sharing in it, but I don't have proof of that. But the corruption is extensive. I've described it as the government of Afghanistan as basically being organized crime from the top to the bottom. Just to illustrate, USAID has put a lot of money building roads, billions of dollars. And why? Well, the theory is to enable subsistence farmers to bring their crops to market and therefore give them additional income. They're no longer subsistence farmers. It hasn't worked. They aren't bringing their crops to market because the police set up checkpoints on these roads, and they extort such a large amount of the crop or money that the farmers are no better off, so they continue to be subsistence farmers. And the corruption really goes to the bottom level, the police, the local officials, all the way to the top. And so the government, neither at the local level nor at the top, is unable to win the loyalty of the population. They may not like the Taliban, but they're not going to turn against the Taliban. And of course, they understand what seems not to have been understood in the United States, which is that the Taliban and the government in Afghanistan are, yes, they're enemies some of the time, but some of the time they're not. Some of the time they collaborate. Nobody is going to turn in a suspected Taliban in his own village if he thinks that person is in league with the local government official, because that would be a sure death sentence.
So, Ambassador Galbraith, you mentioned the Hazaras in the area of Afghanistan bordering Iran, the Shiite minority. Karzai is going to, he's making a visit to Iran next week. And ahead of this visit, Iran's foreign ministry have asked Afghanistan not to sign this security deal with the U.S. I imagine their objection is simply that they don't want a U.S. base continuing there after the withdrawal.
Yes, I would think so. The Iranian government was, in fact, pleased that the United States and its allies got rid of the Taliban, who were committing genocide against Afghans, Shiites, and the Hazara in the Central Highlands, and had actually killed Iranian diplomats. But, of course, Iran does not wish to have the United States on its borders. And so obviously, that they are urging Karzai not to sign the deal. They have a influence. They've been making cash payments to Karzai, and that's been documented.
And have they been supplying the Taliban with arms? There's also been reports on that.
Well, first, when we speak of Iran, it isn't a single entity. There are different elements within the Iranian government, the religious community, and the different parts of the military. So it's possible that some have been supplying the Taliban at the same time as other parts of the government are against the Taliban. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, Iran, as a Shiite state, has nothing in common with the Taliban, who are Sunni fundamentalists and view the Shiites as apostates who should be killed.
And the government of India has built a road all the way up from the Indian Ocean into Afghanistan, into the Shiite area of Afghanistan, which would, of course, be a perfect way to get all that heavy equipment out. Since the Pakistanis are gouging the U.S., they gouged the NATO and the U.S. to get this equipment in there in the first place, and now they're holding them over a barrel about getting this heavy equipment out.
Well, it's also possible to go out through the north.
Right, but the Russians aren't being particularly cooperative.
No, Afghanistan is a difficult place to get into, and it's a difficult place to get out of, but while I'm hopeful about an improvement in U.S.-Iranian relations and think that this tentative nuclear pact is very hopeful, a real way to solve a problem that otherwise has no military solution, in fact, no other solution. Nonetheless, I don't see that kind of improvement in U.S.-Iranian relations, which would allow the use of that road to bring out NATO equipment.
So at this point, is there a possibility of having to leave a lot of stuff behind?
Well, I think a lot of stuff will be left behind, and the U.S. has actually been destroying equipment rather than turn it over to the Afghan security forces. And the reason is that it doesn't trust the Afghan security forces not to give the equipment to the or sell it to the Taliban. And so this is actually a strategic judgment, and it's a reflection of the extent to which all the structures that have been put up in Afghanistan are really part of a criminal enterprise and not a functioning state.
And not only is it a narco-kleptocracy led by a kind of mafia family, Karzai himself appears to be somewhat mentally unstable.
Well, 3 years ago, having denied that he had committed fraud in the 2009 presidential elections on April 1st, April Fool's Day, he abruptly said, yes, the elections were fraudulent, but Afghans didn't do it, the UN did it, Peter Galbraith did it, which was obviously very implausible. And I had to think at the time, and I said it, that he really was speaking under the influence, and there are reports that I find credible that he has a certain fondness for some of Afghanistan's popular product, notably hashish.
Well, some of our listeners might think that's the best thing they've ever heard about the guy.
Yes, that might be, but right. It may not be the best basis for making decisions. So he clearly can be erratic and very emotional. But in this case, I think he's very calculating, and his calculation is that if he doesn't sign, he is hoping to use the signature of the deal and indeed holding his country's future hostage as leverage to keep the U.S. and the U.N. from pressuring him to have an honest election. I think that's really what's at stake here.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, and I appreciate you joining us here today, Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Well, very good to be with you again.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan before being forced out over a conflict on how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. A former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, in 1995, he was the co-mediator and principal architect of the agreement that ended the war in Croatia. And from 2000 to 2001, he served with the United Nations in East Timor and was also a professor of national security strategy at the National War College and is currently a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation. His books include Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies, and The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the less-than-transparent budget deals that are fast approaching a deadline.